The mayor watched this in blank astonishment. That was the start of a couple more days of this township, days devoted to seducing hearts and minds, with younger kids being given rides in the Franklin to see their homes from the air for the first time in their lives, and older kids, heavily supervised, playing with the trolls. But on the second day, the crew went on the alert when a second twain showed up in the sky above New Melfield. The ship was a merchant vessel. That evening the captain himself, with an aide, crossed to the Franklin and met Maggie in her sea cabin. And they came bearing a package. Maggie glanced quickly at Nathan Boss, who'd accompanied them aboard.
"We scanned the parcel," Boss said. "It's clean."
The merchant's captain, young, overweight, grinned at Maggie.
"You must be very important, Captain Kaufman. We were detoured a hell of a way to bring you this. You have the assurance of Douglas Black himself."
"Douglas Black? Of the Black Corporation? The..." Wow, she thought. "Sally Lindsay has contacts."
"Yes, Captain. The Mr. Black assures you that nothing in this package is to the detriment of either you or the Benjamin Franklin. Instructions can be found inside. I know nothing more."
Maggie felt ridiculously like a kid at Christmas, eager to unwrap the gift. As soon as the guy was gone, at Nathan's cautious suggestion, she took the package outside the ship to open it, just for extra security, and inside she found, carefully wrapped, a curious instrument, faintly resembling an ocarina. A troll call. Sally Lindsay had come through. She toyed with the controls. It looked more complex than the gadget Sally had shown her, maybe some kind of upgrade. And there was a brief page of instructions, signed by hand, G. Abrahams. The name wasn't familiar. She couldn't wait to try it on the trolls. She dismissed Nathan, who went off grinning and shaking his head. Then, alone, she made for the observation deck, where the trolls preferred to sleep, perhaps because of its cooler temperature. The trolls were huddled together, grooming gently, half asleep, communicating their usual soft, barely audible tones. Maggie quietly switched on the ocarina, pointed it at Jake, and listened carefully, and was surprised when, from the direction of Jake, a clear voice said,
"I am fed. Satisfied. This is fun. I yearn to return to," meaning not understood.
It emerged as a human male voice, firm, reasonably pleasant, if rather synthetic. So the troll call worked, even if it did seem to be more like an exchange of concepts than a true translation. Those nerds of the Black Corporation, or whoever G. Abrahams was, must have loved working on the development of this thing. Now she pointed the troll call at Marjorie.
"Female here, watching. No mate female, meaning not understood. Tentative translation, a female choosing for her own purposes not to have a mate."
They meant her. "Everybody's a relationship counselor," Maggie grumbled to herself. Plucking up her courage, she raised the troll call and said clearly into its mouthpiece, "My name is Maggie Kaufman. Welcome aboard the Benjamin Franklin." A liquid warble accompanied her words. The trolls seemed to snap to attention. They stared at her, mouths open, eyes wide. She pointed to herself. "Maggie. Maggie." Marjorie gabbled back, apparently attempting to find a label for her.
"Friend, grandmother, interesting stranger."
It was grandmother that flabbergasted Maggie. Grandmother? How human was that? And was that how they saw her relationship to her crew? That she was the old woman looking after all the little children? Well, they were mostly a lot younger than her. She boldly walked up to the trolls, where they sat huddled in a corner of the cabin, and sat on the carpet with them.
"I'm Maggie. Maggie."
"Well, you're right. I have no husband, no mate. The ship is my home."
It seemed to her that Marjorie, the female, was looking at her sorrowfully, with soulful brown eyes. With extreme care, a hand like a leather shovel gently touched Maggie's. Maggie felt she had no choice but to move closer, as she felt huge arms close around her. Carl, meanwhile, got hold of the ocarina and experimented until he found a way to say, "Peppermint." That was how Maggie was found in the morning, coming awake as a crewman, very, very gingerly, unwound his captain from the snoring trolls. Breakfast was somewhat embarrassing. Every last crew member knew how she'd spent the night, but she never had been one for standing on her dignity. She spent a day letting the crew experiment with the troll call under supervision, and she had Jerry Hemingway from science study its workings, or anyhow, its inputs and outputs. That night she had to order the crew to put the call away, to leave the exhausted trolls to their slumbers on the observation deck. Then, at breakfast the next day, she called the crew together. She looked carefully around them and picked out Jennifer Wang, one of the Marine detachment, whose grandparents, she knew, had come from China. "Jennifer, you spent a long time with Jake yesterday. What did he say to you?" Wang looked around, somewhat embarrassed, but she cleared her throat and said, "A lot I couldn't understand, but it was along the lines of, 'Far from home.' It cracks me up. I mean, I'm a Chinese-American and proud to be a citizen, but it's in the blood. How did the big guy know?"
"Because he's smart," Maggie said. "He's intuitive. He's sapient. You know, people, we were sent out here to find sapience in the long Earth, among other goals, right? And now here it is, on this ship, living among us. Sapience. And that, by the way, will be my defense at the court-martial. I'm proud of you all for how you're dealing with your new shipmates. But if this room isn't cleared and you're not at your post in 2 minutes, you're all on a charge. Dismissed."
Chapter 33. The last step across was a sudden transition from a dune field just inland from a grey ocean, the local copy of the Irish Sea, into what looked like a rudimentary industrial park, a place of gleaming tanks, rusty gantries, smokestacks, blocky concrete buildings. There was nothing very space-age about it as far as Jansen could see at first glance. "Come on." Sally shifted her pack and led the way. Jansen followed, walking steadily across grass-covered ground that gradually gave way to lumpy dunes. The morning was dry and bright in this world, one step away from the gap. She could smell salt and rotting seaweed in the wind off the sea. She tried to visualize where she was, tried to imagine that there was vacuum, space. A void, just one tap of the stepper at her waist, away from this mundanity. Tried and failed. They hadn't covered 100 yards when the landscape was illuminated by a blinding light coming from the rim of the development ahead, like a droplet of sunlight brought down to the earth. Without hesitating, Jansen pushed Sally to the ground, lay on top of her, and pulled her jacket hood over her own head. Jansen had been in the world next door when the Madison nuke went off. She hadn't forgotten. The noise of the explosion hit them, then a hot wind, and the ground itself shuddered, but it passed over quickly. Cautiously, Jansen rolled off Sally, wincing as her enfeebled body protested with a chorus of aches. They both sat up and looked west. A cloud of white smoke and vapor was rising up from the explosion site.
"Not a nuke," Sally said. "Not this time. Some kind of chemical factory blowing up. Sorry to jump you."
"Don't be."
Sally got up and brushed away sandy soil. "This place is going to be a playground for tech boy nutjobs who may or may not know what the hell they are doing. Let's watch our backs."
"Agreed."
They walked on, eyes wide open, alert for more problems. A fire guttered at the destroyed plant. As they approached, they could see steam rising from amateurish-looking attempts to douse it. There was no security here that Jansen could see, not even a fence, but as they entered the sprawling facility, they were noticed. Jansen saw workers staring at them. At length, a man walked out to greet them. In his 50s, perhaps, he was not tall, but very upright, wiry, tanned, with graying crew-cut hair. He wore a blue jumpsuit with a faded NASA logo and a name tag, Wood F. He grinned at them, welcoming enough.
"Ladies, gentlemen," Sally snapped back. "The name's Frank Wood, formerly of NASA, and now of, well, whatever you want to call us here. Gap Space will do. We're incorporated under that name. Can I ask why you're here? We don't get too many casual visitors this far out. Are you volunteers? If so, give me a hint of your technical specialities, and I'm sure you'll fit right in. Journalists?" Ruefully, he glanced over his shoulder at the rising cloud of steam and smoke. "You'll see we just had an incident with a LOX storage tank, but that's not so unusual."
Jansen flashed her badge and warrant card. "I'm police. Madison, Wisconsin, specifically."
He glanced at it, but she put it away before he had a chance to figure out she was long retired and shouldn't have kept the shield anyhow.
"Oh."
He looked disappointed in her. "Frankly, Lieutenant Jansen, that kind of datum authority doesn't have a lot of purchase out here, even if we were in the U.S. Aegis, which we're not. I guess you'll hear about the troll thing, right?"
"Afraid so, Mr. Wood."
"Call me Frank."
"I think I recognize you," Sally said.
"You do?"
"The video clips. It was you who stopped that tech guy putting the troll down on the spot."
He actually blushed and looked away.
"Well, I never wanted to be famous. Look, the guy you want to see about all that is called Gareth Eames. Nearest thing to a chief executive we got here. English guy. If I'm honest with you, if not for the fuss in the outer net, yes, we get the news even out here. The troll would have been put down by now, but even guys like us take notice when we're in the middle of a flame war. Come on, I'll take you to Eames."
"No need," Sally said briskly. "I'll find the way."
Wood looked dubious, then shrugged.
"Okay."
He pointed to a low, squat concrete building. "That's the admin block, or the nearest we have to it. We build everything like a blockhouse here. Living with rockets, you learn to be cautious. You'll find Gareth in there. And that's where we're holding the troll, too, in the calaboose."
"Great."
Sally turned to Jansen and whispered,
"Let me get over there and scout it out, without Buck Rogers here hovering over me."
Jansen was doubtful, but this was Sally's modus operandi, she was learning. Always keep the other guy off balance.
"Okay. And as for me? Distract this guy. Let him show you his toy spaceships or whatnot. I think he has his eye on you, by the way."
"Garbage.
Also, let me remind you, my personal rocket ship takes off from a different launch pad."
"So? He's no more perceptive than most men." Sally winked.
"Undo a button or two and he's your slave for life. See you later."
Chapter 34
"We don't think of this world as Earth-West 2 million-plus change or whatever," Frank Wood said. "We think of it as Gap East 1, because the Gap is the center of our universe, not the datum. And a strange kind of world this is, right? Almost empty of humans. Whole continents nobody's even set foot on. We basically live off fishing and a bit of hunting while we build spaceships. We're a tribe of hunter-gatherers with a space program."
As Frank Wood rambled on, Jansen inspected Gap Space. The facility was like a fannish reconstruction of a half-remembered Cape Canaveral, she thought, having visited that old wonderland once as a tourist, and it was there at the Cape, it turned out, that Gap Space people had recruited Frank Wood himself. She recognized basic facilities such as kilns churning out bricks, baked from the local clay, and forges and manufacturing plants. Then there were the traditional attributes of a space center, like huge spherical tanks whose walls were frosted because, Frank told her, they held great volumes of super-cold liquid fuels. The company even had its own logo, a roundel with a thin crescent earth cupping a star field, the Gap Space name below, and above a corporate slogan. There is such a thing as a free launch. Joshua had once told Jansen that that was a line of Lobsang's, And most thrilling of all, even to a hardened old heart like Jensen's, there were spacecraft. There was one capsule-like craft that stood on four robust-looking legs, and a gantry that held a rocket booster, a tank maybe 60 feet tall, topped by a flaring nozzle that pointed oddly up into the sky, as if the rocket were preparing for a launch down into the Earth. It was a stand for static test firing, Frank explained. The workers here were mostly male, mostly around 30 to 40 years old, mostly overweight. Some were dressed in protective gear or coveralls like Frank's, but others wore shorts, sandals and T-shirts bearing slogans from long-forgotten TV shows and movies. You didn't hear about the polar bear? One guy, bearing a sheaf of blueprints, came right up to Jensen, looked her in the face and said,
Neo, huh? It's like one unending con here, man. Am I in heaven?
And he walked off, before she had a chance to reply. Frank raised his eyebrows, as if sharing a joke with Jensen.
Look, this isn't a corporate operation. Not yet. You can see that. These guys are all volunteers, hobbyists. We have amateur rocketeers, radio hams, astronomers, and disappointed space cadets like me, I guess. A few folks back home are funding us privately. The big corporations don't yet see the value of this. Why go to all the trouble of crossing space to some desert world like Mars when there are a billion habitable Earths a walk away? But they'll learn, and no doubt they'll muscle in when we start getting results, and you'll all get rich. Maybe. Anyhow, as you'll have guessed, social skills aren't exactly high on the list of selection criteria here. You'll get used to it.
For Frank Wood, she learned, the gap had turned out to be his chance to recover the dream. Before he was recruited by Gareth Eames, Frank hadn't even heard of Gap Space. But he had been working at the Kennedy Space Center, what was left of it, and it was sad. In the Rocket Garden, the open-air museum, they weren't even taking care of the precious relics anymore, he told her. You could see corrosion from the salty air eating its way into papery cylindrical hulls, gaping rocket nozzles. They still flew unmanned satellite launches, but for a man who would have flown in space himself, such routine shots had all the drama of a garage sale. Frank remembered when he was a kid and watched bright-eyed men on TV explaining how they were going to put mass drivers on the moon and break up asteroids for their metals and build tin can worlds in space and set up beanstalks, ladders into the sky from the surface of the Earth. Who wouldn't want to be a part of that? And then the steppers were invented. Frank was 31 years old on step day, already an Air Force veteran, and had just been accepted into NASA's astronaut corps. But now, you had the steppers and the long Earth. Mankind suddenly had all the space it wanted, a cheap and easy route to a trillion Earths. Once, Frank Wood had dreamed of flying to the planets, if not the stars. Now the spaceships of the future stayed on the launch pad of the imagination, as he worked towards retirement in what was left of KSC. An astronaut candidate reduced to driving a tourist bus, he had felt like an early mammal, scuttling around the bones of the last dinosaurs. Then Gareth Eames, a smooth-talking Brit, had shown up, gabbling about something called the Gap, a kind of long-Earth loophole for space cadets, it seemed to Frank, who at first had barely understood. And then Eames showed Frank a photograph of a spaceship. What struck Jensen most in this brief tour wasn't the space technology nor the nerdish workers, but the trolls. They were everywhere, laboring in the factories beside clunky assembly line robots, lugging heavy loads to and fro, such as enigmatic structures of brick, arches and dome segments, and, in one place, mixing and laying down concrete to build what was evidently going to be a broad apron, like a landing pad. This particular party were singing as they worked, and she strained to hear. Their song, softly sung, was a round based on what sounded like some old pop song with lyrics about wishing you were a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. No doubt they'd picked it up from the local nerd population. Frank Wood didn't even mention the trolls, as if they were invisible to him. After their walkabout, Wood led her to a kind of rough, open-air coffee bar beside the big inverted rocket booster. Jansen sat with relief.
"This is a genuine space launch facility," he said. "I'm sure you figured out that much, but we're in a unique position here, next to the gap, and the way we work is like nothing that's ever been done before."
She instinctively liked Frank Wood, but she was quickly growing tired of the fanboy bragging.
"It seems simple enough to me. All I have to do is take one more step and I'll be in space, right?"
"True," he nodded. "In the vacuum. Of course, you'd be dead in under a minute if you weren't in a pressure suit. Then you'd find yourself being flung off into space at hundreds of miles an hour."
"Really?"
She tried to visualize why. Failed.
"The Earth's rotation," he said. "This Earth. If you're standing at the equator, you're being rushed around at 1,000 miles an hour. The gravity holds you down here. Step next door, and the gravity's gone. But you take that momentum over with you. It's like I whirled you around my head on a rope, and the rope broke, and you just went flying off into space. Of course, we can use that velocity vector if we're clever, but mostly it's just a nuisance. The only stationary points are at the poles, and it's not convenient to work there. That's why we're at a relatively high latitude, here in England. The further north, the better. Or south, of course."
"Of course," Jansen said, uncertainly.
"Which is opposite to the wisdom of launching from the datum, where the lower the latitude, the better, to get a boost from that rotation. What you have to do is step over in a spaceship."
He pointed to the capsule she'd spotted before, like an Apollo command module on four legs.
"That is our shuttle. Adapted from Twain technology, a stepping vehicle, but wrapped in a rocket ship re-engineered from the old SpaceX Dragon. All iron and steel components excluded, right? What you do is step over into the gap. You have to pick the right time of day, when the turning Earth brings you to just the right spot, and the shuttle fires its rockets to take off the spin velocity and bring you to relative rest. Then you dock at the brick moon."
"The what?"
"That's what we're calling the permanent station we're building at the location of the Earth. In the gap. Brick and concrete are easy to make over here, and easy to step in great sections over there, as long as you use mortar and stuff that can withstand the conditions of the vacuum. Even trolls can churn out great chunks of it."
Which was the very first time he had even mentioned the humanoids.
"The station is going to be a kind of honeycomb of sub-spheres in a cluster 200 feet across. Quick and dirty, but we can do what we like here. Whatever we can carry over. You haven't got to cram everything into the nose cone of a converted ICBM and subject it to multiple gravities. A brick structure won't take pressure, but we can install inflatables or ceramic shells within the frame. When it's done, that is where we're going to launch our space missions from."
He pointed now at the inverted booster.
"I guess you recognize this, baby."
"I wish I could say I did," she said sadly.
"It's a re-engineered SIVB. That is, a Saturn V third stage. You know, the old moon rockets. Old technology, but reliable as hell. This is just a test article. We're reworking it in steppable materials. Here's the beauty of the gap. From the datum, you needed a thing the size of the Saturn V itself to get to the moon and back, right? Because of the need to escape Earth's gravity. In the gap, all you'd need to get anywhere, Mars even, is no bigger than this. We've already launched one test shot, a mission to Venus, with a ship we called the Kingfisher. In future, we're looking at nuclear rockets, which will offer a much better Delta V, that is..."
"I believe you. I believe you."
He stared at her and laughed.
"I think we're going to get on, you and I, Lieutenant Jansen. Sorry, I know I get carried away. Look, did you ever read Robert Heinlein? Basically, it's like that here. You really can build a backyard rocket ship and fly to Mars. What's not to love about that? All these worlds are ours, including Europa. Sorry again, another nerdy reference. Listen, Miss Jansen, given the reason you've come out all this way, you mustn't think badly of the young guys here. They are mostly guys. They mostly lack social skills. They're kind of driven. Many of them have some kind of personality disorder, probably. But their hearts are in the right place, generally speaking. They may be thoughtless to trolls, but they aren't deliberately cruel.
He looked distracted.
By contrast, have you ever met anybody who was? I mean, a really bad person? I served in the Air Force. I saw some sights in postings overseas.
I was a cop, she said in answer.
He glanced over and grinned. Was? So when you flashed your badge at me, Lieutenant Jansen...
Okay, you got me. Call me Monica, by the way.
His grin widened. Monica.
A guy in a Bart Simpson cap came wandering over.
You're Lieutenant Jansen?
That's me.
Your friend Sally Lindsay sent me to fetch you. Oh, and she had a message.
What message?
The trolls are gone.
That's it?
The guy shrugged. You coming or not?
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.